Citizenship without the state. It's difficult to give a simple answer to that because we are still caught, I would say, and I think we both try and work on that. We're still caught not only for subjective, ideological, etc. reasons, but for very practical and material reasons within, inside the intellectual limits, I would say, of the nation state as an institution of the citizen, which means that when we try to open the history and the trajectory, I would say, of this political figure, this key political figure of the citizen, the active citizen, in order to imagine its future, or its virtualities, or its new possibilities, something that Sandro referred to, that is not exactly imposed upon us, but suggested, very strongly suggested to us by, I don't think this is by chance, by the increasing use of the language of citizenship in emancipatory and critical movements. We are permanently stumbling, so to speak, upon this limit. So we have enormous difficulties to disentangle the various elements of this institution, and to imagine what public sphere, public services, public institutions could be beyond the nation state. So at a very abstract level, I would try and defend personally the idea that the notion of the citizen, of the figure of the citizen, cannot be isolated from the institutional dimension. But I'm trying to dissociate as much as possible the general idea of polity or the public institution from the historical figure of the state, and particularly the nation state. Now, this is not to say that we've already got beyond the limits of the nation state. It's just the opposite. We find ourselves in a sort of I wouldn't say permanent state of exception. I'd rather use Sandro's terminology: a phase of transition without predictable end. And perhaps even not with predictable or you need unilateral linear orientation. Now, to try and say something less abstract, I would finish with that. I want to refer to what seem to me to be perhaps the two most interesting orientations in contemporary critical theory when trying to elaborate concepts of transnational or post-national citizenship, and therefore also indeed introduce or bring in a new substance, a new content to the old cosmopolitan ideal, the idea of a cosmopolitics and not simply perhaps a cosmopolitan utopia. And believe me, this is not because sitting here with a friend on my right side, I want to ease him, etc. But I think that what we've heard from Sandro, and possibly we could associate with him some other contemporary elaborations, fairly well represents one of these two orientations. And you see, I'm a very eclectic kind of theorist. I want to have it both ways in some sense. Find, if not a middle a way, at least a combination of these two orientations. The other one, if I try again to refer to something I have enormously learned from and found very important in the recent period is, where is it? It's here. It's, I brought it on purpose. It's Sheila Ben-Habib's book, The Right of Others, Aliens, Residents, and Citizens, which was published 2 years ago or so, in 2004, 3 years ago, by Cambridge. Cambridge University Press. Now, Sheila is, everybody knows how important her work has been in many fields of political theory in the recent period. She is, she's clearly a Habermasian. She's a disciple, never acknowledged follower of Habermas, but she's also bringing in some views and corrections to the Habermasian point of view, which have gained more importance in the last period, especially when she started this problem of the status, this post-Arendtian problem of the status of migrants, aliens, foreigners, etc. If I want to summarize that in very quick terms, and I know this is extremely simplistic, I would put Sheila on the side of the formal constitution and Sandro on the side of the material constitution. I don't know if you'd agree with that. I would put Sheila on the side of what Sandro and explicitly rejected a moment ago, that is a normative point of view, which I don't believe we can completely avoid. And I would put Sandro on the side of political theory for which antagonisms, relationships of forces, and therefore, of course, also dynamic processes consisting or resulting from relationships of forces form the core of the issue. This is not to say that Sheila has a purely juridical point of view and Sandro has a purely political point of view. In fact, they both combine. the juridical and the political, but they tend indeed to articulate them in a very different manner and with a different primacy. Now, Schiele's point of view on citizenship is basically referring to the permanent gap, if you like, or distance that remains between the principles of modern democratic public institutions or states or possibly post-national constructions such as the European Union, for example, and the actual working of the institution, and therefore the point of view of exclusion that Sandro was referring to is central to her considerations. What she points at, and this is where she refers to an Arendtian notion of stateless, etc., individuals, is the fact that the institution in practice, the construction, the violent construction and enforcement conservation of states, and therefore the association of the idea of the citizen with national membership, citizenship within the limits of a given state, in fact excludes precisely those which the principles of a liberal democracy should include. So therefore, you have norms that or fundamental principles of fundamental rights, which, for example, associate citizenship with freedom of circulation or with rights of settlement and residence, which become violently contradicted in practice. And it is this contradictions which concentrates, so to speak, in the concrete figure of the stateless, the migrant, the refugee. And the more, of course, the borders of states, of nation states, become relativized by the processes of globalization we were telling about, the less migratory movements are marginal, the more they become normal and central aspects of social life in today's societies, the more this contradiction becomes visible. It's not created, but it's more and more visible, and in a sense less and less tolerable. So on Sandro's side, if I well understand his point, and perhaps I simplify, but I think that he's been repeating that in a very forceful manner in his presentation a moment ago. What is constitutive of the notion of citizenship is not a constitutional framework. It's not, if you like, a certain way of providing the construction of a community, call it a polis, a polity, a politeia, a constituency, a state, etc., to a certain universalistic principles. It's the fact that citizenship is a history, and this history is created, so to speak, or is produced, or is regularly set in movement is started again by the agency under the impact, I would say, of action and force and needs of certain typical figures, so concrete historical figures. Yesterday, this might have been the proletarian or the social worker. Today, not in an exclusive manner, of course, but in a privileged manner, this might be the migrant or the nomad, if you like, but in a broad sense of the term. In fact, it's the social figure of these groups and individuals who challenge the existing border in the sense that Sandro was describing. And I like his idea of his critique of the certain use of the notion of exclusion, his idea that in fact the problem comes from the fact that such groups and individuals are already included and integrated in some sense, but at the same time they are imprisoned, so to speak, or enclosed in limits and borders which prevent them from playing the constitutive role that they are destined to. Now, as I said, I want to have it both ways, in a sense. That is, I believe in the importance of the contradiction signaled by Sheila. And I don't think that this is only a moral contradiction, or a logical contradiction. I think that this is very central and a crucial political contradiction that has kept acting and transforming citizenship throughout the history of the modern state, or more generally the modern public institution, particularly by continuously challenging the limits established between active and passive forms of citizenship, or if you like, subjection on one side, inclusion as subjection, and inclusion as agency or constituent power, to borrow this terminology, on the other side. This has been the case for the working class in after the Industrial Revolution. It's been the case, of course, for women. And here we have to not only pay lip service to, as usual in such conversations, to feminism itself, but in fact to acknowledge the extent to which the very notion of citizenship in the West and in the world, generally speaking, has been transformed and revolution by the permanent drive, in fact, of women's liberation movement and women as a group. It's been the case with the colonial liberation movement, and it's the case today, in fact, with this broad category, heterogeneous, widely heterogeneous a group of people who, in Europe particularly, find themselves in the totally absurd and contradictory situation of being labeled strangers or foreigners, by one set of discourses and institutions, and on the other side, fully integrated and included in the social and cultural life of our countries. Of course, the construction of the European Union is adding an element of tension and also visibility to this situation. It pushes the contradiction to an almost dilemmatic form. The foreigner becomes dissolved in many respects as a legal and social figure. And I concur on this point with Sandro. That is, it becomes torn, in fact, between two possibilities: citizenship or becoming citizen or becoming enemy. Now, on the other side, I want to not only keep something, but acknowledge something absolutely crucial from Sandro's point of view, namely precisely the idea of forces. You do not transform history without the intervention of forces and social forces. And this is where the name, the names used by Sandro and his friends, multitude, nomadism, etc., have a very important positive aspect, because if they are not transformed into metaphysical entities, they precisely describe this conflictual dynamic we are thinking here. Only what I think, and I finish with that, and the more the discussion goes on, the more I return to something I had written already 20 years ago, when the issue of immigration became for the first time burning and politically urgent one in France, with the advances of the National Front and so on in the early 80s, and the post-colonial dimensions of that conflict also started to emerge in full light. I had written an article called in French "Sujet aux citoyens," subject or citizens, concerning the situation of North African immigrants in France, and trying to push it to add the theoretical dimension to that. I said at the end, what is important is not so much the fact that migrants are granted citizenship in the legal sense of the term, for example, become easily naturalized. What is important is that in the political sphere, in the political space, to use the same terminology, of which we are talking, which is still to some extent the national space, but is also increasingly becoming a transnational space, aliens, migrants, refugees, etc., etc., be treated on an equal foot, footing, be granted the same rights as the national staff. That leads to the idea that the polity of a constituency, so to speak, has to be periodically renewed, founded, grounded anew. And this can be done only, of course, and this was part of the questions that we were asked, nature and basis of solidarities between migrants and others. It would be only too easy to start by explaining not the basis and the reasons of solidarities between migrants and others, but just the opposite. I mean, the reasons and basis of antagonisms and violent incompatibilities between migrants and others. But still, some solidarities can be constructed. They can be constructed at the level of human rights movements, but also of social reivindications and claims, and even perhaps at the level of cultural resistances against precisely the global capitalist homogenization. Right now, this seems extremely difficult to imagine. It's a sort of vicious circle. Take working classes in France or in Britain or in Italy. The more they feel that the process of the European construction is threatening their historical acquired collective identities, the more they, so to speak, turn their hostility and anxiety as well against migrants, or they can be pushed in that direction. But in fact, in many respects, the resistances against homogenization and the struggle for a certain form of multiculturalism in the positive and creative sense of the term is a virtually common struggle. Now, if this were to there are many ifs in all that. If this were to advance and grow and progress, then a political subject would emerge, and I think that is already there in an embryonic manner in some respects, which is neither the abstract citizen, the bearer of universalistic rights that you find in Sheila's description, nor, and I hope I'm not caricaturing your position, the nomad who is disrupting and transgressing the borders, but a sort of co-citizen, if you like, or combined, mixed social alliance of residents and nomads. This is where I see possibilities of an emerging citizenship that is not entirely enclosed or bound within the limits of the traditional nation state, but which is not, of course, which is not indeed opposed to every notion of institutions, rights, and public sphere.
So, yes, I would like to ask you. No, you have no right now.
You're not a citizen.
Is there any questions?
Hi, my name is Natasha Stanselberg.
You have to speak microphone.
And my name is Nadja Stumselberg. I'm from Center for Cultural Studies. I have a question about theoretical influences. And neither of you mentioned Agamben, and you only mentioned it, Sandra, in the when you talked about borders. And you mentioned Hannah Arendt, and Agamben clearly has a lot to say about the stateless, the refugees, especially sort of, and you know, in connection with Europe today. So I was just wondering what's your position on this one.
Thank you.
I mentioned only dead figure.
I will take another 4 hours.
Well, I understand why you asked the question, but this is part of the current debate. I mean, in that case, I will mention Sandro has a very powerful influence on me, and I don't ask him to mention. This is part of a current debate, which in a very interesting manner is already transnational, but which is not completely global. It retains some heavy, in fact, Euro-American form of domination. But there are some figures already emerging from other places in the world, from Africa, from Asia, from Latin America, that's been the case for a long period now, who, it's not, don't misunderstand me, I'm not saying that they are now co-opted and accepted in the academia. I'm saying that the borders precisely, or the limits between their debates and our debates are less and less, more and more elaborated, mediated, transformed in a process of translation. The process of translation is a process of different, also of conflict. But so we're progressively moving to a genuinely transnational, re-centered debate on all these issues. And in such a debate, of course, everybody influences everybody else.
Okay, before, can I suggest we collect just a few more questions as well, and then
you
can respond to Agamben.
Can I just be loud? Well, that'd be fine, yes. Question had to do, I mean, I very much appreciated at least what I felt was a sense that there's nothing necessarily positive or to be welcomed about heterogeneity, that in a sense, I mean, one of the lazier aspects of some discourse about globalization is precisely this constant celebration. And I liked, especially in Sandro's presentation, the fact that heterogeneity is also hierarchy, exclusive inclusions, and so on and so forth. Now, it seems to me that one of the principal manners in which this heterogeneity is governed, produced, and neutralized when it's politically problematic is through discourses and practices of security, in some sense or not. And I mean security in a quite broad sense, I mean to include both national, I mean, discourses that are symbolized as national of respect, civility, not in the sense that Etienne means, but nevertheless, and more transnational or global discourses about terrorism or indeed ecological security or energy security or whatever. And it seems to me that one of the things that almost no left, progressive, whatever you want to call it, political or radical political discourse has produced is not just a critique of security, which in one way kind of is fairly often very self-evident, but an understanding of what would be forms of politicization and organization that can neutralize these mechanisms of security. And part of the reason why I ask this is because it seems to me that it's almost inevitable to, as much as one may have a transnational global dimension, nevertheless to problematize these mechanisms at a level that's at least symbolically national. You know, issues about racial profiling, about identity, about deportations, and so on. One can recognize that the mechanisms themselves are spread out in a transnational way, but these are... So I was wondering in what sense... I mean, first of all, I suppose, in what sense can one think of political forms of countering or neutralizing mechanisms of security? And secondly, in what sense can one evade being thrown back onto, at least symbolically, a very, very national dimension about, you know, whether it's in the discourse about extraordinary renditions, in the discourse about identity cards, or what have you. So that's the question.
That's for you.
Any, should we take just one more question?
I'll talk about this. One of the things that I'd be interested to hear you just talk on briefly is the question. You both were very, very interesting about the whole question of citizenship. I wonder.
Give me a name, please, that I put it here for
us. Oh, Stephen. Stephen, same as you, Etienne.
Stephen.
Yeah. The issue I'd be interested to hear your views on is the question of whether secularism is an important component of citizenship. And I'm asking you this particularly in the context, and this relates to the previous question, you know, when we have, you know, there's frequent discussion of a war on terror, which is arguably, you know, a religiously constructed discourse against another religion, against Islam, a sort of a Christian versus Islam. So I wonder, and of course a lot of the issues in France and Britain concerning the rise of far-right politics concern the construction of religious others, as well as the fact of, you know, the rise in relation to Chaitin's work of authoritarian religious movements as well. I wonder if you could just address that question of whether you see secularism as a component of citizenship.
I'm particularly happy that you asked this question because I think it was one of the most interesting questions.
Sandra, we've lost your microphone.
Okay. I think it was one of the most important questions that had been listed by Manuel and Chitten, and that we are in the time to discuss about it. So I will try to say something about three questions that have been asked. I will try to be short, and so forgive me if I will be a bit schematic, especially talking about Giorgio Agamben. I like to say that he is a very brilliant thinker, philosopher, and so on. I hope this is not necessary. Nonetheless, I have some problems with Agamben, and I want to talk very openly about these problems. The first problem I have has to do with the kind of influence is exercising in different cultural fields, but I will refer only at refugee studies and migration studies. I think that Agamben's elaboration of the concept of their life has led to a situation in which you can only denounce the destruction of agency and possibilities of agency by not only refugees and migrants, but also any, let's say, subaltern subject. And I could give a lot of examples of this. It seems to me that this kind of influence is leading to the diffusion of a criticism of migration and refugee policies that is basically an aesthetical criticism that doesn't take into account the possibility of agency on the side of migrants and refugees. I could also say something about the influence he has in urban studies and in architecture. It's a wonderful book, really wonderful book, written by an Italian young architect about transformations of spaces with a global scope. This young architect is living nowadays in Palestine, so there are really impressive chapters on defense in Gaza. He is part of a collective of architects named Multiplicity that produced really impressive exhibitions around the issue of borders. For instance, they did a video exhibition on the different paths that Israeli citizens and Palestinians have to follow to go from one point to another in the same territory. So 1 hour, wonderful, smart highway for the Palestinian, for the Israeli citizen, 6 hours of really very, very hard journey for the Palestinians. They videoed it and they showed it in a single room on the two walls of the room. It was really very, very impressive. And so the title of this book by Alessandro Fetti, is really a very good book, is Archipelagos and Enclaves. And once again, I think that the influence of some of the concepts that have been introduced by Agamben leads to a kind of polar contraposition between these two different kinds of organizing spaces. You know, the archipelagos are the spaces that are globally connected, while enclaves are the spaces that are cut off from any kind of connection. From my point of view, I would say very, very schematically, the point is precisely to think of the connection between these different kinds of spaces. And this is a point you don't address if you start from such a concept as the one of bare life that has been developed by Giorgio Agamben. Second footnote to Agamben. I just read his last book. It is an impressive book, really impressive book. The title is The Rain and the Glory. And what is particularly interesting is the first part of the book, where he tries to further develop Foucault's genealogy of governmentality. He has a very strong point. That is, you cannot understand governmentality in its economic rationality if you look only at the 16th, the 17th, the 18th centuries, at the centuries of the so-called sciences of politics. You have to go back. You have to go back to the first centuries of the Christian age, and you have to look at the whole discussion between the fathers of the church on the question of Trinity. And if you look at this discussion, you can find the formulation of a kind of paradigm of what he calls economic theology. And this paradigm is what has been elaborated upon in the first centuries of the modern age, and is what is still dominating our present. I mean, it is a brilliant analysis, but it is a kind of, let's say, Heideggerian analysis, in the sense that it seems that our destiny, the destiny of everybody sitting in this room, has been decided by the discussion on the question of Trinity in the first three sentences of the Christian age. I mean, this is something I cannot accept. And this has to do with Agamben's style of thought. Stop yet. Okay. A little bit back. The question asked by Alberto is for me a crucial question. I will tackle the issue of security only from the point of view, let's say, of social security, that is of security in daily social life. And let me say, Etienne is very much aware of that. I'm not an anarchist. I don't particularly like the word nomadism, especially because of the rhetorical use that is being done of this word. Nonetheless, I think that we are confronted with a very important problem, that is to make sense of different and new practices of mobility that are in a way no more contained in traditional images and institutional frameworks of citizenship that were devised on a different kind of mixture between fixity and mobility. But I was saying, I'm not an anarchist. This means that I take seriously the question of institutions that has been raised by Etienne. This means that I don't particularly like analysis, critical analysis, of the question of security that limit themselves to say, oh, the question of security is a social construction, it is something that we have to dismiss because it is only a rhetoric. Okay? I think there is a problem of security. And I think that it is very important to address this problem of security. I think it can be done in a much more effective way by practices of social movements that refound citizenship than by state institutions. I will limit myself to give two very concrete examples. First one refers to Buenos Aires, where in many peripheral neighborhoods, the question of security has been addressed by social movements involving the so-called pibe chorros, that are the teddy boys, you know, that are really very, very strongly criminalized, both by the public discourse in Argentina and by the real teddy boys, that is the police of the province of Buenos Aires, which is well known for being a particular police. Okay? And this involvement of the so-called pibes chorros has led, in particular situations, to a different kind of awareness of the possibility of inhabiting this space that was a deeply insecure space in a different way. Second example refers to the city I originally come from, that is Genoa. In Genoa, there was a real problem of security a couple of years ago that had to do with the spread of transnational Latin American gangs, especially in the old city. I mean, it was a real problem because you were walking in the old city. There's very narrow streets, as many of you know, at night, and you could be attacked by four teenagers that were really very violent, really very violent. And there was no proportion between the degree of violence and the aim of the attack. You know, in order to have your mobile phone, it could really, I mean, destroy you. Yeah, it has happened also to friends of mine. Okay. What has been done? I think it is a quite interesting kind of experience because it started from the university, where a couple of critical researchers have done very good investigation on the condition of Latin American teenagers living in jail. Genoa is nowadays one of the hugest Ecuadorian cities in Europe. And this investigation has involved many of the protagonists of these gangs. It has approached them, it has developed a kind of relationship that has led to the idea of making a kind of peace agreement. This idea has been endorsed by the municipality that in a way has sponsored this public meeting where leaders of these gangs came from New York to Genoa and were in a way tutoring this peace agreement. After that, this is particularly important and interesting, a social center that was squatted several years ago in the western part of the city has intervened in this whole process and has offered to these hundreds of teenagers to self-manage the center one day a week. This is a process that has led to a really very sensible transformation of the situation as far as security in an important public space as the old city of Genoa is regarded. In Milan, they had the same problem. The solution was the police. The solution was arresting many of these baby gangers. And the situation is just the same as it was a couple of years ago. Well, the last question on secularism and citizenship, I'm running out of time. So I will take this question as the only quick-fire question that has been asked in our meeting. Secularism, citizenship. I think we need to relaunch a critic of religion that at the same time points at the limit of secularism. I think that we should advocate not only secularism, it can be a little bit provocative in these days, but even political ethics. I really feel a need for a new kind of campaign, you know, for political ethics. In which sense I was saying that we also need to go beyond secularism. Has much to do also with my own view on citizenship. On this point, I think that Marx has given us very important critical views. I would like to reread a very important, in my opinion, quotation by the young Marx. Just the same page where defines religion the opium of the people. But soon after he writes, criticism has plucked the imaginary flowers on the chain, not in order that man shall continue to bear that chain without fantasy or consolation, but so that he shall throw off the chain and pluck the living flower. In order to take up this kind of statement, this kind of approach, means on the one hand to oppose the use of the legion that is being currently done to deepen a radical critique of religion, but on the other hand means also to take seriously religion, to take religion seriously. I think that this is one of the passages where Marx is closest to Spinoza.
My turn.
Wow, difficult.
Security, of course. Turn off his mic. That's done. Okay. I wait for him? No. No. I think that the conflict over the issue of security and insecurity as a concept is an absolutely crucial ideological issue in today's world. My position on this is basically, if you want to simplify, is the one that that has been, in fact, advocated by the former Secretary General of the United Nations in his reply, in fact, to the President of the United States on the occasion of the General Assembly, I think 2 years, 3 years ago, Kofi Annan. And I was very impressed by his discourse on this occasion. And I say this on purpose because I've read these days, recently, a very brilliant, but in my opinion, extremely unfair attack on Kofi Annan by one of the leading Marxist theoreticians of our time, namely Perry Anderson, who's written an article that you can find in perhaps the, I don't know if it's the last issue of the London Review of Books or just before that. It's a commentary on two recent biographies of Kofi Annan. So you can say everything. He's corrupt, he's been weak in this or that occasion, because he had failed in his action as a commissioner for human rights in Africa in the tragic circumstances of the genocide in Rwanda. After that, he found himself unable to raise his voice against the superpowers. Notwithstanding all this, when President Bush had explained before the United Nations that the essential problem, the key problem of contemporary politics was now to build a world alliance against terrorism, which would, against terror, transform it one of these metaphysical entities, not denying that there is terrorism, evil terror, which encapsulates a number of, in fact, a whole range, which allows it to establish a sort of continuous chain, which connects on one side petty criminality in urban neighborhoods. Bombings, to Al-Qaeda, terrorism, and so on. Therefore, allows it, and this is one, I believe, of the main, of the worst aspects of contemporary politics, to completely fuse or merge together the action and the idea of police forces on the one hand and warfare on the other hand. Therefore, building this comprehensive, complex figure of the enemy. What Kofi Annan basically replied was not, there's no problem of security. He said just the opposite. He said, in fact, there's a huge problem of security, or better said, of insecurity, and insecurities in today's world. But you cannot reduce this problem to one single aspect. Again, we are dealing here with the issue of heterogeneity, but we—it's more than that. It's, I would say, a genuine process of appropriation, and therefore expropriation. Also, of course, on the other side of the issue of insecurity. Now, this amounted to explaining that depending on the site in which you are located as an individual, but especially as a social group, ethnically, geographically, socially, from the point of view of gender, or of color, or race, etc., it's not the case that you do not face all the different aspects of insecurity. You can be a victim of terrorism, of course, even and perhaps especially if you are an Iraqi or a Palestinian citizen, and you are a victim of genocide or ethnic cleansing and conflicts. Not only also, but perhaps above all, if you belong to the poorest and most oppressed populations of the world. But it is the case that these different forms of insecurity are not combined and perhaps hierarchized exactly in the same manner. So, a cosmopolitan point of view, precisely on all this, is a question asked before the public opinion of the whole world, asking first to have a complete enumeration and description of basic forms of insecurity. Second, address, of course, the way in which they affect different people and articulate with one another. How this general economy of violence does function. What are the links and the chains that articulate extreme poverty, seeming natural catastrophes, starvation, migration, and risky lives, as for example, taking going on a boat, trying to leave Africa to reach Europe, an aspect of the risk society, to borrow another well-known formula, which is only too often marginalized. And then, of course, warfare and endemic civil wars, and in the end, of course, imperialist or neo-imperialist interventions and their very strange combinations with humanitarian aid and so on. So that's a whole chain. And it has to be entirely, it has to be described in its complexity, and it has to be hierarchized from the point of view of different groups and populations in the world. And I think that this is an absolutely crucial political and ideological issue. And therefore, I don't think that anybody here would be of a different opinion, but I try to express it as clearly as I can. My point of view is not that we should reject the language of security or the, but we should contest and challenge the appropriation and therefore expropriation of the problem by some forces and some states in this world. And ask the question as more at a more general and popular level. Second, concerning secularism, on the occasion of the the controversy over the voile islamique, the Islamic veil in French schools, which has been widely reported and discussed as an example. In different manners. I mean, it's been interesting to see that in some cases, either from inside France or from outside other European countries, it's been presented as a typical example of the consequences that a certain form of laïcité, and this is very difficult to translate, it's not exactly secularism in a generic sense, it's state secularism, can provoke, or in other cases it's been presented as very significant, perhaps extreme forms of the conflicts and contradictions that the post-colonial situations generally produce in the European countries, therefore not isolating France from others, but on the contrary, I mean, putting them together. So I don't repeat what I said on that occasion, but in a footnote, you'll find this, sorry to referring to my own writings, in an article called Dissonances Within Laïcité, which was translated into English in the journal Constellations 2 years ago, published by the New School for Social Research in New York City. I tentatively said that there were different models of secularism or laïcité and in European history, and that they could be traced back in some sense to the classical systems of political philosophy, and simplifying very much, I said there are three. There are basically three models. There is a Hobbesian model, there is a Lockean model of tolerance, if you like, and there is a Spinozist model. Now, the first two are not too difficult to explain, because they are institutional. They become institutionalized in some sense, whereas the third one is more fuzzy, and it's, although I believe that it's practically also there. The Hobbesian model was not, in fact, implemented in its native country, that is, in Britain. It's basically the one that's been implemented in France. Hobbes is the real father of the French conception of life, of life. Why that? Because Hobbes was obsessed with the problem that he powerfully, wonderful, super developed, explains in the third part of Leviathan. Usually in classes, political theory, you teach the first two the first two parts, and you leave aside the other two, which are in fact the key to the whole volume of a Christian commonwealth and the kingdom of darkness above all. The kingdom of darkness, that's the Catholic Church. A very provocative theological political predicament. Now, Hobbes was obsessed with something that became the central issue in Catholic countries like France or also Italy to some extent, which he, whose concept he borrowed from the Catholic cardinal and theologian, the great figure of 17th century debates, Cardinal Bellarmine, the potestas indirecta, the indirect power of religion, the church, and more particularly religion. Namely, the idea that the theological element, having been forced to drop, to abandon the direct political exercise of political power, has managed, in fact, to exchange it for something which is much more important from the political and ideological point of view, what in the end Althusser will call ideological state apparatus, namely the cultural, ideological, and religious government of spirits, minds, and consciousnesses. And therefore, of course, Hobbes's vision is that at all costs, if a rule of law, that's not a totalitarian view, don't believe that, a rule of law, a secular state where power does not derive from transcendent representations, but from the intercourse or common activity of the citizens themselves, if that is to exist, the religious element has to be pushed back as completely as possible into the private sphere. That's one element. Does not should not play any public role. Therefore, ultimately, in the limit, you shouldn't have something like a religious political party playing a role in politics. And second, the state itself, indirectly, it's the counter use of the notion of potestas indirecta, has to support and enhance a system of public education which promotes non-religious and in fact anti-religious values based on science, secular ethics, law, or legal concepts and so on. So that's one possibility. Then I'm quicker. You have Locke's possibility. Locke's possibility does admit, of course, not only does admit, but it favors the idea that religious communities or collectivities play a public role. With a tendency, I do not demonstrate that, but it can be, I think it can be argued, the tendency to confuse, that is very important in today's controversies, to confuse religion and culture, or to identify religion and culture. What is a religion? It's basically supposed to be the cement, the substance that binds together a cultural a community, and this has to be recognized publicly, provided, of course, and this is an important proviso, the or qualification, the belonging or the membership to religious communities or cultural religious communities is entirely voluntary. And therefore, of course, you have to set a limit. That's the limit of the Lockean tolerance, which prohibits, in fact, or excludes from the public spheres those religious beliefs which, in fact, are coercive or intolerant themselves. And especially, that's very important, excludes atheism. And finally, the Spinozist position, which the one I would tend to develop myself, and I would stop there, leaving Agamben to a critique of his country. I'm not so critical as you. I believe in theological invariance, but that's a long discussion. But I don't believe in the generalization of the model of the camp. Leave that. The Spinozistic model is a model which shares with Locke the idea that democracy or free republic, in his opinion, in his definition of the term, is one in which the religious beliefs and communities contribute to the public debate. Therefore, it is one that accepts that risk, but it is aware indeed of the fact that it is a risk. And the antidote, to use your terminology, that Spinoza sees in this respect is the possibility for non-religious, he calls that philosophy, a philosophical atheist, in fact, discourses to play also a role, in fact, and a heretic or a antithetic role in the confrontation of beliefs, something like, and I'm turning to Nadia, a non-community being involved in the conversation of the community. So that's a difficult idea, and from the institutional point of view, it's on the edge, because it's neither the Christian Republic that you have in Locke, very much realized in today's United States of America, nor the state secularism that you have in the case of Locke, but again, something that has to do with the institutional establishment of